Welcome to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. Patrick Hicks is writer in residence at Augustana College, and he's the author of The Commandant of Lubezech and The Collector of Names, Adoptable, and other titles. He has recently returned from a research trip of sorts where he visited the site of the Ravensbrück Nazi concentration camp. And he joins me now at the SDPB studios at the University of Sioux Falls. Patrick Hicks, welcome. Welcome back, and welcome back to the show.
Thank you. Thank you on both accounts.
The background for this journey of yours is an interesting one. Why go here? And then let's talk a little bit about the site itself, where you can stay.
Yeah, sure. It's, Ravensbrück, the concentration camp of Ravensbrück. It was built in 1939, and it was very unique in the Nazi universe because it was the only camp that was designed explicitly for women. And this makes it unusual for the Holocaust story. It doesn't naturally fit our Holocaust narrative and our understanding of what the Holocaust was. So I was intrigued by this. I remain intrigued and kind of horrified by this gendered violence which took place. The Third Reich was arguably the most patriarchal system that the 20th century ever saw. And we have this camp that was devoted for all of these asocial women. And it's a story that has been told before, but I'm drawn to it because I don't think that it's as well known as other camps in the system.
Yeah, you say it's been told before, but I have not heard of it.
So recently, by recently, I mean maybe in the last, say, 10 or 15 years, people have become more aware of it. It was behind the Iron Curtain, and because of that, there were quite a number of documents. I think also the fact that there were all women prisoners there, it made it less desirable to know about the place. Everyone's focus is rightfully on Auschwitz and some of the other camps. So I think for a variety of these reasons, that's why it's not quite as well known, but there's Sarah Helm wrote a fantastic history of Ravensbrück called If This Is a Woman. There was a popular novel called Lilac Girls. I can't remember the name of the author right now, but that came out several years ago. So there's been sort of a renewed focus on it, and I was and still am drawn to this place.
And you go and you can stay. What does it look like now?
Well, when the Soviets liberated it in 1945, in April of 1945, and we can talk about what that process was like. They were not, shall we say, kind liberators to the women that were there, speaking euphemistically, I guess. Yeah. And after the things began to calm down by 1945, 46, 47, it was turned into an army camp, an army base. So all of the wooden buildings were completely demolished, but the stone buildings, the brick buildings remained. And when the Soviets finally pulled out of East Germany, this is like 1994, the army base was completely turned back to the German government. And since then, the government has worked hard to kind of restore the camp as an act of commemoration.
Mm. And can anyone stay there? Is it only for scholars who are doing research? I mean, you want to avoid it being a touristy sort of destination and have it be an educational experience. Explain how that works.
Yeah, you know, that's one of the. I'm a big one for. It's my life's work, I guess, is educating people on the Holocaust, genocide, hatred, that kind of thing. And yet, I'm also aware of something called dark tourism, where people might go to these places for. You know, I'm not sure why they're going, maybe not for educational reasons, I guess, but Ravensbrück is set up as an educational center. And part of Ravensbrück was built in 1940 to house the female guards. And these buildings, when the camp was liberated in 1945, I mean, they were only 5 years old, so the Soviets didn't knock them down. And now, rather curiously, and I have very mixed feelings about this, they've been turned into a youth hostel. So when I was at Ravensbrück, actually it was exactly a week ago that I was at Ravensbrück, I was able to stay in this hostel, and the room that I had belonged to an SS female guard at some point in time. And the crematorium and the gas chamber were, you know, maybe 100, 200 yards away from where I was staying. And, you know, I was right in the thick of the camp. And that was a very interesting experience, especially at nighttime.
Yeah. You're not going to sleep very well.
You know, that's what I should say on the radio is that I had a very fitful night of sleep. But the truth is, I was so exhausted from walking around the camp. It's really emotionally hard to be there. Yeah. I slept very well. You know, I should not say that, but when my head hit the pillow, I was kind of aware where I was. But I had a good night of sleep. Yeah. That's not as good of a story, but that's what happened.
Except that's the reality of your situation being there versus somebody else's situation being there. The stark difference is not lost on you. The fact that you could sleep there, and that you were fed there, and you were tired from walking.
Yes.
So all that sort of lays itself out in front of you as a, you know, as a visitor, as a scholar, but then also as a writer. So this must be part of your ongoing research. Is this something that you're writing about now? Yeah. Is it something you're filing away for? We'll see what happens.
Yeah, I'm sort of working on the idea of a new book. So I'm in the information gathering stages, and I'm creating characters, and I'm interested in this idea of gendered violence, because the female SS guards that were there, they were every bit as brutal and pernicious and awful as their male counterparts. And in fact, Ravensbrück became the training center for all of the female guards throughout all of the system. So many of the women were trained at Ravensbrück and then later went to Auschwitz, for example. And yet the rate of prosecution was far higher amongst the female guards, because they were seen as this total aberration that, you know, women should not be capable of such violence. And, you know, I would argue that that is still our sort of mindset today. So I'm taken by all of this. And I should say quickly, I've been talking about female SS guards, but that's not technically correct, because the SS was a very strict patriarchal system. Women were not allowed. So when I talk about female SS guards, they were kind of an auxiliary to the SS. They were not allowed to be a part of the SS as women. They were called Aufseherin, which would be the English translation, like maybe matrons or overseers or something like that. So they were not a part of the SS. Mm-hmm. So as we talk about this, I might slip and call them a part of the SS, but they definitely were not.
What is the purpose of this camp? Is it different than the purpose of other camps that we know so well?
Yes. It was originally designed, it was built in 1939, and it was a place to house women that would have different political points of view from the Nazis. So it would be full of social democrats and communists, for example. The Jehovah's Witnesses, there was a high percentage of Jehovah's Witnesses at Ravensbrück, because they believed that, you know, you follow Jehovah, you don't follow the Führer. So they refused to sign on to be a part of the Third Reich. Asocial women, lots of prostitutes were there as well, for example. There was a small subcamp called Uckermark, which was behind Ravensbrück. And this was for girls, really, ages 16 to 21. Then they would be put there. And we have these horrible stories of, let's say you like swing music, you know, let's say you like Glenn Miller, and you were caught dancing in the Third Reich, you would have been sent to Uckermark. And then ultimately maybe moved to Ravensbrück. So there was a wide sort of swath of women. There was one woman that I ran across that was put in Ravensbrück because she refused to put the portrait of Hitler in her classroom.
Wow. With so many women, there have to be children. Many of these women had to have been mothers. Or what happens to the children when these women go to this camp?
Yeah. There was, you know, these heartbreaking stories of women being separated from their children, sometimes not having any idea what happened to their children at all. There were children that were born in Ravensbrück and were later murdered, either through, say, lethal injection or starvation. Abortions were carried out at Ravensbrück. And so it's a place of overwhelming suffering. And I noticed in the introduction there were medical experiments that you'd mentioned that happened there. The more that I find out about this place, the more heartbreaking it is. And as I said earlier, it doesn't fit our natural sort of inclinations of what the Holocaust narrative should be. Mm-hmm. So, for example, there were Jewish women at Ravensbrück, but the percentage was pretty low, especially 1942, 1943, because they'd all been transferred to Auschwitz by that point.
You mentioned abortions being carried out at Ravensbrück. I was reading one story this morning about midwives being sent for performing abortions, but then being at Ravensbrück and being told to perform abortions.
Yeah.
Were they performing those abortions as an official act of the guards, or were they doing that in secret?
Yeah, that's again. This is it, one of the
history that I was reading was a little unclear. Well, yeah. You know, they were put there because this is what they were accused of doing, which was illegal in Germany at
the
time.
You're absolutely right. But yeah, abortion was illegal in the Third Reich. I mean, if you're trying to create the master race, the very last thing you want to have is, of course, abortions, illegal abortions, being carried out. So many of the women were arrested as midwives or doctors that would practice abortion, and they would be put into Ravensbrück, and they would then have to carry out the very thing that got them into Ravensbrück in the first place. Mm. So it was a place where these kind of things happened pretty routinely. And I mean, say you're a doctor and you're charged with saving life, you go to Ravensbrück and, there's no way for you to save life. And, so we find stories of some of the doctors, turning to lethal injection and other things like that.
How do they train the guards? You mentioned this sort of notion of, this is not what people considered a natural role for women. Mm. Women shouldn't be cruel. Women shouldn't. They may be held to a different standard than. I don't even know how do you put some of these things in context when they're so, I guess I want to use the word evil. But were there ways to sort of train the female guards that created the system that we end up seeing in history now?
Yeah, there were about 3,500 Aufseherinnen, the female guards that went through Ravensbrück. That's quite a lot. I mean, the camp existed for about 6 years. So that's, we're talking hundreds of women, thousands of women over the course of these years. And the training was pretty exact. Almost all of the women learned how to be dog handlers first in Berlin. Many of them were between the ages of 18 and 25. Almost all of them had a lower form of education. And because of the age group that they were, many of them came of age, in the 20s, and they were firm believers of the Third Reich, and they believed that there were such a thing as Untermenschen, this idea of a subclass of human beings. So once you put all of this and you aggregate all of this together, you can see that they did believe that they were performing some kind of service for the Third Reich, and they got to serve alongside their male counterparts. And it allowed them to have this sense of license and power. And again, I go back to the idea the Third Reich is a patriarchal system where women were, you're supposed to stay home and you're supposed to raise kids. That's your job as a female Nazi. So it's a system that is specifically designed not to allow women to have power. And then suddenly you have these 18 to 25-year-olds that have enormous power over the lives of other humans.
What happens to them after the liberation, those women? Do they tell their stories at some point? Are they punished? Are they integrated back into society? There's a lot of them.
Yeah, there are a lot of them. And they're very quiet after the war. Many of them, the prosecution rate was higher amongst the women guards than the male guards. Some of them were executed. Many of them did anywhere from 5 to 10 years of service. And then they kind of disappeared back into daily life. And very few of them talked about their experiences as female guards later on. By later on, I mean the 70s, 80s, and 90s. Right. There's a very interesting... she wasn't a female guard. She was a prisoner, and her name was Anne Spory. And she was an assistant to a doctor, and she did some very questionable and ruthless things to her fellow prisoners. And we know that one of the ways that she kind of maybe searched for grace and redemption is she went to Africa, became a pilot, and she would fly from village to village saving lives. So each one of these people had to deal with their crimes in their own kind of way.
Hmm. Talk about the liberation of this camp. Like how much was it known that, from the people who lived around it I'm thinking back to Commandant of Lubezeck and this notion that these transport trains would come by and the questions of, what do the villagers know about what's happening and how do they react to their own knowledge? What kind of denial are they in? How are they sort of oppressed to where they really can't do anything about the things that they know? In this geographic location, what was known in the surrounding area about what was happening at Ravensbrück?
I was curious about that because the town of Fürstenberg Havel, it's a beautiful town, still is a beautiful town. It's a town of lakes. It's surrounded by three lakes. It's a place where people in Berlin, it's only an hour north. It's where they go to hike in the woods and, you know, paddle around, motorboat around the lakes. It's Fürstenberg Havel is a beautiful little town. And it was a strong seat of Nazism. So I did run across some accounts of people that were living there, and you can see Ravensbrück right across the lake, the Schwedt Lake. So if you're in the camp, as I was last week, I mean, I could hear the church bells. I could hear the car horns. And alternatively, if you're in Fürstenberg Havel, back in 1945, you would have been able to look across the lake and you would have heard the gunshots, you would have heard the dogs barking, you would have definitely have seen the tarry smoke coming out of the crematoria. And yet the accounts that I ran across, the people always referred to it as the women's camp. They didn't call it the concentration camp. They called it the women's camp. And they believed that it was mostly full of asocial women that were, you know, communists or prostitutes, that kind of thing. And they saw these prisoners in town with great deal of regularity. They were, you know, marched to and from in the camp. So they knew what it was. Whether they knew what it was is another question. Right. I mean, you see smoke came out of a crematoria. You hear small arms gunfire. I think they knew what was happening, and they have decided retrospectively to say they did not.
Right. That's a theme for you in your work, to really not only explore the experience of the people who are prisoners, but to explore the point of view of how does a guard become a guard?
Yeah.
How does a bystander become a bystander? Do you have insight into that after researching and writing it and sort of getting in the mind of those characters, or are you still stumped by it in a certain way? Like, I read your book and I read the history of this. I see movies and I always get stuck where I think, like, how the heck can that happen? Like, how is that even possible? I get mad and sort of say ignorant things like, you know, like, oh, I've had it with the Nazis, you know, just like, I'm so like, why? But you've gone to a deeper level. And do you get that same point of frustration where you're like, it just shouldn't have happened? Or do you see patterns that say, I know why this happened and it is this and it can be avoided?
Yeah. Wow. I really love this question because it does get at the heart of so many things. I mean, ultimately, we study the past to help illuminate and clarify the possibilities for the future. And that's one reason I turn my gaze backwards to the Holocaust, because I do think it can teach us things about what we are capable of doing to each other as a species. And that's one of the things that I'm aware of, especially with these female guards between the ages of 18 and 25, because part of me is, sympathetic's not the right word for sure, but I can see in this system without power, where they're given power and they're given clothes, they're given a place to live. You know, these are women that didn't have much of an education, and suddenly they're given purpose and they're valued. I can see why that would be attractive to them, and yet the monstrosities that they perpetuated against innocent human beings is this riddle, which I'll probably spend the rest of my life trying to understand how that could be possible. Because you would have these female guards, they would go back to their barracks, they would laugh and joke, write letters, you know, play card games, have a couple glasses of wine, act very much like, say, they were in college or something like that. And then they'd wake up the next day and they'd grab their dog and their whip and go to work.
They believed that these people were not humans.
Yeah, they believed these people were not fit for life, that if they weren't producing and working, they didn't have a right to eat.
Were there any, where do you get the stories? Are the stories recorded through, you know, archival material of the camp itself? Are they recorded by survivors? How are we learning this history even today?
All of the above. When I went to the camp last week, but I also went two years earlier, the people that run the Ravensbrück Memorial website and the camp, they do a really good job of trying to make it a place of education and commemoration. So I learned a lot. I learned a lot about individual stories, and just walking the camp helped me to understand the historicity of the place. And I, the, some of the books that I mentioned it when we were first started talking, they were instrumental in helping me to understand the history of the camp itself. So I aggregate all of this together, and I think hopefully it'll help me maybe tell the story in some kind of way.
Yeah.
But even the work that the women had to do at Ravensbrück itself was based on gender. And Heinrich Himmler, who was in charge of the SS, he believed that these women who he would believe were, you know, an underclass and not women to begin with, he still wanted them doing female work. So they did. They were forced to do sewing. They were forced to make socks. They were forced to repair clothing. So they didn't do, quote unquote, man's work of, you know, creating machinery and things like that.
We need to take a quick break. We're going to come back with more with Patrick Hicks in a moment. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB Radio. Welcome back to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. We're talking today with author and professor Patrick Hicks from the University of, from Augustana University, Augustana College, Augustana University. His books, in case you haven't read them yet, The Commandant of Lubezech, Collector of Names, Adoptable, This London, There's Poetry, Short Story. Commandant of Lubezech is a novel, a really compelling novel about World War II. And we're talking to him about his trip to Ravensbrück, which is the only by design female concentration camp that the Nazis created during this time. Talk a little bit about life at this camp. You talked about the women working, and then let's move toward this time of liberation.
Sure.
Start there.
Sure. And to be clear, I suppose, you know, Auschwitz did have a female part of the camp, and the other camp, like Bergen-Belsen, had women in the camp. So I just want to sort of clarify that Ravensbrück was unique insofar as it was only designed for women. But believe it or not, they did have a very small men's camp at Ravensbrück. There were about 1,000 men there. So, but Ravensbrück towards the end became really unique as far as I can tell in the Nazi universe, because up until about mid-1944, there were a lot of women dying from starvation and violence, just being exposed to the cold. Often the women were forced to stand at attention naked, you know, in the elements while, you know, the roll call was happening. So it was a place of great misery. But the last few months of Ravensbrück, it kind of took a turn in a direction that, as far as I can tell, it was unique, because by late 44, a gas chamber was built at Ravensbrück. And it was built right next to the crematorium. And while this has happened in other camps, Ravensbrück was the first time, so far as I can tell, and with my research right now, that the Nazis were murdering people not for any ideological reason, as they did with the Jews, for example. They were murdering the prisoners because they needed extra space in the camp. As Germany began to collapse and the Soviets began to advance and the Americans and the British and Canadians and the French began to advance and Germany began to shrink, Ravensbrück, because it's so close to Berlin, more and more prisoners began to get shoved into Ravensbrück, almost all of them women. And they just didn't have the capacity to feed them or clothe them. And in fact, they put up a huge tent and they stuffed about 4,000 women just underneath this tent and, you know, let them sort of starve to death. But they did build a gas chamber, and that's what makes Ravensbrück fairly unique, because there was no ideological, you know, or racial reason why these women were being gassed. They were only being gassed to save space. And the gas chamber was ultimately destroyed. But they even had these mobile sort of vans on rail carts that were brought in. So still to this day, you know, Ravensbrück is unique for a variety of reasons. I could call it an extermination camp. That is correct. But yet at the same time, that term extermination camp really only resides with the Operation Reinhard camps, Auschwitz, Treblinka, Sobibor, Belzec, which I write about in The Commandant of Lubezec. So it's towards the end, Ravensbrück gets very muddied and confused and deadly.
And they can't be afraid of, or are they? It seems like they're not afraid of some sort of military uprising with these women. They're not a huge threat to the Third Reich.
No.
They're just a threat through their existence that they exist.
Yeah.
Or at this point, are they a threat to being discovered?
Well, that's the ironic thing. I mean, people had known about Ravensbrück for quite a while, and we even have this incredible situation where one of the delegates from Sweden was able to get these Red Cross buses sent into Ravensbrück in February, March, I can't remember exactly which month of 1945, and several thousand women were liberated because of the International Red Cross. And this is largely because Himmler was trying to cozy up to the Allies and, you know, trying to save his own neck and his own skin. So we have these, we have this very strange moment where the commandant and Himmler are saving some of the lives of the women at Ravensbrück. And then as soon as those buses leave, they go back to gassing the women. It's this turbulent and it's like this frenzy of murder. But we also have this great moment of humanitarian relief.
You said at the beginning of our conversation that the Soviet liberators were not kind liberators to these women. Tell me what happens when the Soviets come and liberate the camp.
This is a history that's really only come to larger light maybe in the last, again, 15 or 20 years. But when the Soviets liberated Ravensbrück, they, as I say, they weren't kind liberators, and we have these awful stories. These women had survived the camp system, and then they're liberated, and we have systematic raping, which is happening in the camp. Many of the women are so exhausted that they actually end up dying because of, you know, the acts of their liberators. And the same is true not just for the prisoners at Ravensbrück. This is equally true for the women in Fürstenberghavel. And in Berlin, women were being raped with such rapidity in Berlin in 1945 that there was sort of a code word amongst the women of Berlin. They'd instead of saying good morning or how are you, they'd just say how many times today. So, you know, this is one of the things about the liberating Soviet army that I think we need to know more about. And certainly if I'm writing about this all women's camp, I cannot write the liberation as if, you know, it's all roses and happiness at the end. There were many women that made it to liberation, and then their pain kind of just shifted to a different type of uniformed pain.
What are the... trying to compose myself now here, Patrick, because this is really, a difficult story to talk about. What are the lessons, even now for us today, that we still continue to, as we process the horrors of this, that we still say, it matters that we treat all people as people. I mean, that's one that comes to mind. What else comes to mind to you where you say, like, rhetoric matters, or, you know, the language we use matters. What are some of the lessons that we're still gleaning from this period of history?
Yeah, and I think this is one reason why I feel really compelled to learn more about Ravensbrück, because this, you know, I've been studying the Holocaust for a very long time, but even in my own understanding of it, I have not really focused as much of my attention as I really should have on the gendered violence of the Holocaust, which I kind of knew was there, but that's one reason that I'm interested in finding out more about this place. And I think that that's one reason why it's been in shadow, because it's not a pleasant story. As I say, it doesn't fit our Holocaust narrative easily, because we're not talking about people that were murdered for some racial idea. And we have violence that's committed by women upon women, and it is uncomfortable studying Ravensbrück because there are no easy answers. And I can't offer one right now, but I think that it's worthy of our study, especially when we think of the role of what does it mean to be a person in society today, and, you know, what can we learn moving forward to become better in some way.
Yeah.
You know, I was aware, you know, tomorrow we've got this summit in Singapore, in North Korea and America. And, you know, there are concentration camps in North Korea. I really think the president needs to confront the human rights issues from North Korea. There are people that are suffering greatly in concentration camps in North Korea.
Yeah. We have spoke, and you and I believe on this program even, about sort of, once you're into this research very deeply, finding a place for you to sort of, you know, write poetry about you know, something that has nothing to do with this, to sort of keep your own. So let's pivot a little bit and talk about, like, how do you, you know, figure out how to endure? And I by no means want to compare what you go through in studying to what anybody who is even remotely, you know, touched by this history has had to go through. On the other hand, I think it's remiss to not say this is a difficult research project for an author to sort of live in this space.
Yeah.
How do you figure out how to live in this space and do the work that you feel needs to be done? And also, you know, get ice cream with your son on a Saturday, you know,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
You know what I'm asking? Yeah.
I do. And, you know, when I was at Ravensbrook, I was just aware of where I was. I was aware of the between 30 to 50,000 women that died there. We're not entirely sure how many, for reasons I can go into later. And while I was walking around, you know, I did about 15 miles that day. My feet were sore, and I was like, oh, you know, I wish I had an aspirin. And, you know, and I felt guilty about, you know, wanting to relieve myself of pain. But now that I'm back here in South Dakota and I'm doing research still on this camp, you know, I find sort of places that I can go that are like getting ice cream with my kid, or I'm reading David Sedaris's latest book, which is hilarious, and, you know, walking my dog and just enjoying being alive and being grateful that I live in a country that does not have a system like this, and being able to use what skills that I have to make people aware of how fortunate we are.
Yeah. We're going to close with just a quick mention of the Great American Read that PBS is doing. You can vote every day at sdpb.org/greatread. And let's just ask Patrick Hicks before you go. You'll have to come back and talk more about this. But what makes a great book? What do you think is essential in a great book?
Wow. Yeah. Well, I'd like to, I could plug my own book, I suppose, The Commandant of Lubezeit. It seems kind of gauche, but what makes a great book? I think it's a story that transcends time, and we see characters that are in a situation that makes sense to us, that we can kind of navigate our way through it. I think one of the reasons that we read fiction is that it allows us this social labyrinth that we can step into, and we follow the main character, and we kind of silently think, would I do that? Would I do it the other way? And it's a way for us to sort of test how we might go about solving problems. And I think that's one reason we're so drawn to stories, is we just want to see if we would do something similar. So I think a really good story is riveting, it's gripping, it has some sort of message that transcends, you know, a single life, and we keep wanting to revisit it and go back to it.
Yeah. Patrick Hicks, author of Commandant of Lubezeit and Adoptable, this London collector of names, and many more to come, which we look forward to hearing more about. Thanks for being here. Come back again.
My pleasure.